Well, we have one more speaker who needs no introduction, but who's going to get one anyway. We all know that the father of the neoconservative movement was Irving Kristol, and I hope I have the quote right, who once said he was a liberal mugged by reality. We don't have the father of the neocon movement, but quite honestly, we have the son of the neocon movement here. Bill Kristol, as many of you know, once served as chief of staff to Education Secretary Bill Bennett. I first had the pleasure of meeting him when he was chief of staff to Vice President Quayle. And by the way, Mike, do you have to have a connection to Indiana to speak here, or does it just help? At the time, I was the executive director of the National Republican Senatorial Committee. After we parted ways, Bill went on to author numerous books, including co-authoring the bestseller, The War Over Iraq. He is a regular contributor on Fox News, one of the talking heads that actually makes sense. The founder, yes. The founder and editor of the Weekly Standard, and of course, I've gone on to become dependent on a government check. Last week, I think it was last week, the last time I saw a soundbite from our speaker, he said Republicans need to engage in political entrepreneurship. That may be a kissing cousin to entrepreneurial insurgency. I'll let he and Thaddeus debate that a little later. But one of the keenest observers of Congress, one of the keenest observers of the conservative movement, a man that we can learn much from, please help me welcome Bill Kristol.
Thank you. Thanks, Jeb. It's good to be here with you. Good morning. Appreciate all of you getting up so early. I always like being with House Republicans. They're my favorite kind of Republicans. That's because I've actually worked in the executive branch with executive branch Republicans, and that's a tough thing. But the main reason is I grew up in New York on the west side of Manhattan, and my congresswoman was Bella Abzug. Yeah, that's what made me a conservative at a young age. I then went to Harvard, and my congressman there was Tip O'Neill, the Speaker of the House. And it was really one of the great moments of Susan's in my life when we moved to Virginia and got Frank Wolf as our congressman. So I guess there's no one here from Massachusetts, since unfortunately we have so few New England congressmen anymore. But I'll tell you a story about what it's like to live up there. In 1984, I was teaching at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. I was the token conservative on the faculty there. They like to have one at all times. You know, it's useful for the students to know what one looks like, I guess. Useful when they get out of school and they have to have a job interview, too. And I voted, I remember we lived just outside Cambridge in Belmont, Massachusetts, actually pretty close to where Mitt Romney lives. And I remember voting in November 84, and I voted for Reagan, obviously, for re-election to the presidency, and voted for the Republican Senate candidate running against John Kerry, actually, in Kerry's first Senate race. I'll interrupt the story to say that about a year and a half ago, Senator Kerry was on Fox News Sunday, and we were talking in the green room, and he vaguely remembered I had some Harvard connection, and he asked when I had lived up there. And I said I'd been up there in 83 to 85, teaching at the Kennedy School, and I said, you know, laughing, I said, I voted against you in your first Senate race. And maybe you're not aware of this, but John Kerry doesn't have a great sense of humor, so he sort of pulled himself up and said, you voted against me? And I said, of course I did. I mean, I'm a Republican, a conservative, nothing personal. You know, he won by 10 points. And he looked at me and said, Bill, you know, my opponent was not well qualified for the job. It's like, gee, lighten up, Senator Kerry. You know? So, anyway, I voted against Kerry, and I voted against, and Tip O'Neill was our congressman, obviously, a Speaker of the House, a revered figure in Boston. And as a loyal Republican, I knew it was hopeless. I voted against Tip. And I remember the next morning, Susan had the Boston Globe open to the election returns. This was pre-internet age. And I knew Reagan had won, of course. I knew Kerry had won. And I was curious how many votes the Republican running against Tip O'Neill had gotten. And I remember asking Susan, you know, and she was looking at the election tables, and I said, how many votes did the Republican running against Tip get? And Susan looked at the Globe and kind of looked again and said, I hate to tell you this, there was no Republican running against Tip O'Neill. And I said, I know I voted for someone against Tip. It turned out I had voted for the communist. This is a true story. It's a, shortly after, actually, Bill Bennett, whom I knew slightly, called and asked me to come work for him, and I had to have a job interview in the Reagan White House to make, you know, get political clearance. And I was trying to, I remember this with Becky Dunlop, some of you may know her, who was kind of the ideological enforcer, I would say, in the Reagan administration, made sure the Reagan cabinet, you know, the appointees in the cabinet departments were true Republicans and Reaganites. And I was kind of nervous there in the White House, and in this, I guess it was the winter of 85, and trying to have to pass this test before coming down to work for Bill. And I remember trying to break the ice and saying, you know, I've been I was originally a Democrat, Scoop Jackson Democrat, but I've been a Republican for a while, and I supported Reagan, I debated for Reagan at Harvard, and voted for against Kerry, and I said I tried to vote against Tip O'Neill, but unfortunately there was no Republican, so by mistake I voted for the communist, I said, sort of chuckling, and Becky looked at me with this totally serious face. I said, here in the Reagan White House, voting for a communist is no laughing matter. Which is why it was a great White House, and she only held up my appointment about 2 months, you know, and then finally I got to come to Washington and move into, I guess, Frank Wolf's congressional district. I had a slight interlude in the 90s when Jim Moran was my congressman. That was depressing, but now they redistricted, thank God, and I'm back with Frank. It's good to be here. I'll be brief. We could have a discussion. Congratulations on a very good start to the session, and really a very good week, I think. I think you surprised the media with your unity and surprised Republicans, honestly, around the country who were so dispirited after the last year or two, and maybe you even surprised yourselves, I don't know, but it was very important. But I would say just as important as the unity, I mean, it was symbolically terribly, very good not to lose anyone, but you know, there isn't, how should I say, there's some safety in numbers, but there's more safety in good arguments, and really the big achievement of the last 2 weeks was the arguments you made, I think, against the stimulus package, as much or more, I would say. I mean, if you got 178 votes and you hadn't convinced the country at all, and you were getting hammered everywhere, and even conservatives didn't really understand what the reason to oppose it was, or even if only conservatives understood the reason to oppose it, that would be a limited achievement. The big achievement of the last 2 weeks, and it was a pretty big achievement in the face of Obama's popularity, the fact that a new president always gets the benefit of the doubt on his first big initiative, to be able to oppose it in unison and so far win the debate on it is a very big deal. I mean, I think it really takes a lot of the momentum away from the new administration and the Democratic Congress in terms of the rest of their agenda. It makes the media realize that just because the president says something, or certainly the Democratic congressional leadership do, that those arguments aren't necessarily either good arguments or winning arguments. And it's very important to establish that precedent in people's minds. It means they'll look more skeptically at the next pieces of legislation in whatever area. So I think it's a very big deal what happened last week, and it's something you really should feel proud of. I was talking to Scott Rasmussen, the pollster, yesterday morning, who should drive me down here, we had a chat. He thinks, I mean, the thing will get through, presumably, some version of it will get through. No president in modern times has ever lost on his first big signature piece of legislation. Reagan got his tax cuts, Carter got his energy program, Clinton got his tax increases, Bush got his tax cuts. Having said that, Scott thinks that if this did not have Obama's personal credibility behind it, it would now lose, the stimulus package would collapse, basically. It is so unpopular in the country. Among independents, it's 2-1 negative now. And the Senate Democrats, if you've seen the papers the last day or two while you've been down here, are really now nervous. Not just Ben Nelson in Nebraska, who seems to basically have gotten off the ship entirely. Claire McCaskill was interviewed yesterday. It's going to need changes. Now Schumer is saying it's going to need changes. The key is now going to be to monitor the changes and see if they're at all serious, and to hold Senate Republicans, actually, now in unison against it. Which brings me to sort of a point I think that is generally applicable. I think there'll be a certain sense of relief that you guys did such a good job, and pride, and you'll sort of begin to think about moving on to the next thing, but that would be a mistake. because the fight is we're only a bit through the fight on the stimulus package and the broader issues that it raises. One of the most important things you guys can do, I think, over the next 2 weeks while it's being debated in the Senate is keep up the intellectual assault on the package. I mean, it will make a big difference for your colleagues in the Senate, you know, how the public perceives this. You all have a real interest now in winning this argument that you've started very well. And I think exposing the ridiculous parts of it, finding a different part of it to highlight every day, getting yourself obviously out in the media to discuss it, challenging the administration to pull out certain things, cooperating, if that's not too much to ask, with some of your Senate colleagues, to highlight certain parts of it and have them go out and pick up things that you guys discover. I mean, you've done the most work on it so far. You know the bill the best. And you've got some credibility on the bill and some access to the media on it. I think it's very, very important to keep up the momentum for the next 2 weeks. Otherwise, you could have had a nice victory. Sort of fades away. Everything goes to the Senate. It gets confusing because they change the bill some. Some of the senators kind of get weak and start to jump off the ship. And then suddenly what happened here was kind of a one-shot deal. And even, in fact, the bill's going to come back to you, and you've got to think through the strategy of that. And assuming you basically would prefer at this point to be able to oppose it coming back and to have as much unity in opposing it as possible and to continue to win the argument as much as you can, you really have an interest, I think, in keeping this assault up for the next 2 weeks. And it might be more than 2 weeks, incidentally. I'm not so sure they can ram this through the Senate in 2 weeks at this point. If they've got real problems of rewriting the bill and they're going to have to balance some of their own guys, the Senate has different rules, obviously. I don't know exactly how obstructionist Mitch feels he can be. You know, there's a downside to looking like you're just trying to throw sand in the gears. Anyway, I think it's a very good start, but I would say, and very important to show that you're not intimidated, that just because the president and the new administration say something's important doesn't mean that everyone's going to roll over and say, oh, okay, we don't even get to look at it. I think it's a very important week or two, but very important to keep it up. The administration's not going to, they're intelligent people, the president and Rahm, maybe not the vice president so much, but I can't resist. You know, I work for Dan Quayle, who was such a good guy and really a good vice president, and it's such a bum rap from the media, which we never succeeded in fixing, which was a great failure of mine, I would say, as his chief of staff. And the idea that Joe Biden, who is really just a buffoon, if I could say honestly, nice guy, I mean, nice guy. He's been here since he was 29 years old in the Senate. You know that huge list of legislative accomplishments he has. Been wrong on every. He's a great foreign policy expert, except he was wrong on every single major foreign policy debate of our time. And the Cold War, the first. He was against the first Gulf War and for the Iraq War. Now I'm for the Iraq War too, but from a Democratic point of view, it's like he got everything totally wrong. And now he's in the White House. That'll provide some comic relief for the next 4 years. It certainly should intensify our good wishes, our best wishes for President Obama and his well-being. Seriously. But anyway, I couldn't resist mentioning Biden. But look, they're going to come back. They're not going to be passive. Rahm is capable of thinking up various things to put pressure the other way on Senate Republicans and on you guys. This move to get Judd Gregg as Commerce Secretary, which I hope doesn't work, would be a very big, you know, kind of a clever way to kind of get the bipartisanship stuff back. Also would be a way to deprive Republicans. I mean, Judd says he won't take this, I gather, unless the Democratic governor of New Hampshire commits to appoint a Republican to replace him. I mean, what kind of Republican the governor would appoint would be a question, and I think that would be very bad news. Anyway, that would be a good story for them if they get a Republican, major Republican, deficit hawk senator to join the administration and give them some credibility. They're going to do things over the next week or two to make the counter-argument and make you guys look as if you just want to do nothing, you don't even understand there's an economic problem, there's the Bush Republicans again. I think you've done a good job of getting away from that in the way that you proposed your alternative and haven't just said do nothing, obviously. But my only message is, you know, this is we're about one-fifth of the way through the fight. We're not through this fight. And this fight itself, of course, is just the first round of 15 or maybe 30 or 50. The one lesson I take from this, though, and I think it's important, you're in the minority, you're not going to win that many votes. Putting pressure on the majority in the administration really matters. I mean, people make more mistakes when they're under pressure. And one thing you can do they made a mistake in this bill. I think it was ridiculous for the president to let the speaker and OB and others sort of have such a free rein to just put together this ridiculous wish list of old Democratic proposals and just shove it into one package and claim it's a stimulus. So they made the original mistake, but I think you put more pressure on them, which caused them to make subsequent mistakes. They're not taking out the contraceptive stuff. They are taking it out. Well, then they're not taking out the next, whatever it was, the National Mall or something, and they are taking it out. You really, when you're in the minority, one of the best things you can do, it's like being a smaller basketball team playing a bigger and stronger one. You know, you got to put pressure on them to try to make them make mistakes. And I think the good news is they are capable of making mistakes despite the, great momentum they have coming in. One more thing on this. Once this passes, let's assume something passes. I was thinking about this last night. It seems to me one thing someone should do, maybe it should be you all in the caucus, maybe it should be the RNC, someone needs to monitor what happens to all this money. I think you could imagine, if you had a really huge monitoring project, and this is something where you could use citizen involvement, I mean, shouldn't Republicans all over the country demand to know where the stimulus money is going in their communities? Shouldn't they demand transparency at the state and local level? Shouldn't they report back to you, someone, to you guys or to, Michael Steele or someone, horror stories from every state, locality, congressional district? They could have bought for themselves with a stimulus package 2 years of bad stories of, the money that was supposed to go for energy efficiency in this town in Georgia is actually going to God knows what, the mayor's cousins, something or other. And you can imagine just an incredible string of local and national stories about how the stimulus money is spent. So in addition to keeping up the fight for the next couple of weeks, I think it's important to keep up the fight for the next 2 years. Generally speaking, oversight is very important when you're in the minority, but usually one thinks of oversight as oversight of the federal government in Washington. I think you need to have oversight of the federal government's expenditures outside Washington too. Now, how you do that is tricky, but I think it could be a chance to energize a huge number of people on the grassroots. I mean, you guys should ask all your constituents to report back to you on how this money is spent. Rush could ask all of his listeners to call in with stories about how it's spent. You could have just an incredible drumbeat for weeks and months, I should think, of embarrassing story. And some of this money is going to be spent in truly ridiculous ways. So I think maybe the stimulus package was a huge gift, actually, by Obama and the Democratic Congress. I was actually surprised they went with this first. They have a lot of other things that are more popular. And they made this their signature legislation, at least for now. And I think you really need to keep focused on it, I would say, and not let it go. It will help affect the whole dynamics of this session. So I think opposing bad legislation, being united in doing so, making the right arguments, following up afterwards is very important. Oversight's gonna be terribly important. I won't dwell on that. Some stunts is a good idea if you're in a minority. I very much liked Mr. Carter's wrangle rule. That was a very clever, and who knew, now you can have the wrangle rule, the Daschle amendment, the Geithner corollary. I mean, there could be a huge number of, it's really wonderful what the Democrats actually have given us some pretty good opportunities here. I do think, again, thinking about how to follow up on that. You introduce something like that, you get 2 days of good press, and then there's a tendency to drop it. But of course, April 15th, there'll be a huge focus on taxes. You should really think about how to revive that, I would say, in the first two weeks of April. I do think the Rangel plus Daschle plus Geithner plus a general set, well, Blagojevich, obviously, I think they're sort of getting close to a critical mass of being a party that doesn't obey the law, many of whose major figures are not terribly scrupulous about obeying the laws, and I think it would be worth just keeping the pressure up on that. Again, you never really know ahead of time, I found in politics, what's gonna catch on. I mean, you can have an instinct, but sometimes things catch on that you didn't think would catch on. Sometimes something you think is brilliant sort of kind of goes nowhere. You just have to try a lot of things and see which example sort of catches the public's imagination. But I think it's important to have a lot of these examples, a lot of these ways of personalizing and making concrete the character of the Democrats. Obviously, you need to propose serious alternatives in many areas as the minority. Most of them aren't going to go anywhere, but it's very important, A, for the sake of the country to do it, because some of them might affect the legislation, and B, so that you can honestly say that this is not just a naysaying opposition party. And I think on some issues it's going to be easier than on others. I mean, one thing some things you know are going to come up and you can really plan for. Other things, you're going to be reactive to Obama and to the leadership. The tax cuts are going to expire in 2010. They really should be a coherent Republican proposal, I would say sooner rather than later. I wouldn't wait till Obama does this, on what to do on tax reform and preserving presumably the tax cuts, maybe improving some of them, that's out there early, that establishes the Republican message on taxes, and then almost colors the way Obama's proposal, which might take a while to come, I suspect, looks. You know, I think it really is important to get, on issues where you can get an alternative out earlier, it's important to do so. Some of these issues, it's very complicated. Some issues, you all won't agree on an alternative, and I think that's fine, incidentally. I'll come back to that in a minute. But where you probably could get close to agreement, which might be the case on tax cuts, I think it would be worth spending some real time coming up with that and doing it before the administration. Don't always look as if you're coming out after in response. And let them be asked about your proposal. Let Larry Summers spend some time explaining why he's not for keeping taxes low and why he wants to hold open the possibility of raising taxes in a recession. Guantanamo, I was talking with Pete Hoekstra about this. I mean, Obama's taken, in my view, really an irresponsible position on Guantanamo. We've done a lot of work on this in the magazine. Steve Hayes and Tom Joslin have a new piece up online today about who these guys are and the difficulty of sending them different places. You know, maybe there's a proposal that you all should introduce to either keep Guantanamo open or certain conditions that would have to be met before it could be closed. And again, let the Democrats explain why they don't want to have hearings on your proposal and why they don't want to allow a floor vote. And again, here a little cooperation with the Senate wouldn't hurt. Senators really can get votes on things, you know, on the floor. So they could highlight things that you, I mean, I think it's as much as you can. I know it's impossible for you guys to cooperate across between the two bodies. It would violate 200 years of Washington precedent and all that. But there are things you could introduce that you will have a tough time, obviously, getting a serious floor vote on that the Senate could help with. And so there are some issues like that. I'm sure there are many others I haven't thought of. Finally, I would not rule out affecting actual legislation in the next 2 years. I think the best analogy for your situation is probably 1977 to 80. 93, 94 is a pretty good analogy. I was a little bit involved in that. Many people here were. The truth is, though, in 92, Clinton only got 43% of the vote. We picked up 10 House seats. We had some momentum. He made some terrible mistakes that I don't think Obama's going to make in his first few months. And we were able to really get momentum, kill the health care plan, and obviously Republicans took over both houses in 94. I think that would be ambitious. I mean, if that happened, that would be fine. I think that's quite unlikely to happen over the next 2 years. Probably the better model is 77 to 80. Republicans were in much worse shape in 77 than you guys are. I think there were 141 Republican congressmen at the beginning of the Congress in 77 and 38 Republican senators. By 1980, they won the Senate. They had a working majority in the House by 81. And they, of course, Reagan got elected president in 80. And people forget how much the Republican minority in Congress from 77 to 80 contributed to Reagan's success in 80. You know, the amount of the serious criticism of the Carter administration, the discrediting of a lot of what Carter did, the proposal of fresh alternatives by Republicans led by Jack Kemp and Bill Steiger in the House. Actually, it was the House, not the Senate, that led in those 4 years on economic policy, to some degree even on foreign and defense policy. It really was important. The critique of the Carter administration helped lay the groundwork for what Reagan was able to do in the campaign in 80 and then obviously in governing. So if you want a sort of a model in your mind, I think that's not a bad, maybe that's a more realistic model than 93, 94. It'd be worth actually talking to people who were around then and who really, I wasn't, I mean, who were in the middle of that. Obviously, things have changed a lot since 1977 in terms of media and all kinds of things, but it would be worth interesting to actually see how they thought of that. I'll just make 2 points about that, though. Carter had, you know, of course, terrible economic policies. The Republicans were hammering away on taxes. That was the beginning of the supply-side revolution. We all remember Kemp Roth and the groundwork that was laid for Reagan's supply-side tax cuts in 1981 by the senators and congressmen from 77 to 80. People forget that actually Bill Steiger passed a capital gains tax cut in the summer of 78 and they put enough pressure, they were more Southern conservative Democrats then, granted, they put enough pressure from small businessmen on moderate and conservative Democrats that Congress passed, and Carter had to sign, a Benson-Steiger cap gains tax cut in the summer of 78. I don't think it's out of the question that you guys could, on some issues, do it, put enough pressure on, make the life of moderate and conservative Democrats difficult enough, reach out to them in a way that has to be sincere, I think, because you really do want not just to embarrass them and create rifts between them and Pelosi, though that's fine too, but you want to actually get them to work with you on some legislation. And it's really interesting. If you had said in January, I imagine I wasn't around, if one had said in January of 77 that the Democratic, overwhelmingly Democratic Congress, with a new popular Democratic president, Carter started off pretty strong, was going to pass by mid-78 a cap gains tax cut, people would have thought you were crazy. And it happened, and it happened, and this is my sort of final point, it happened due to entrepreneurship by backbenchers. And I love your leadership, and I'm sure they're doing a great job, and it was great that you were united in this first vote. But I really think it's important, as Jeb said, you know, for, political entrepreneurship. There are a lot of ways you can, names you can give this. Let 178 flowers bloom is the way I was thinking of it. People really should take the offensive and make their arguments, and not, it's more important to put a lot of good arguments out there than to be totally united on everything. You're not going to get the stuff passed anyway. Very nervous applause from Mike Pence. That's okay, you know, right? No, first of all, you all don't agree on everything, and there's no point pretending you do on some things, and I think some healthy debate is useful. You know, the people who led the House in 77, 78, John Rhodes of Arizona and others, were decent people. They didn't agree with Jack Kemp and Bill Steiger on the supply side economics agenda. And they had vigorous debate, and a lot of people looking at it said, boy, the Republican Party's in even more disarray than we thought. Not only did they have Watergate and Nixon, not only did they have the 74 elections, not only did Gerald Ford lose in 76, but now they're fighting among themselves in the Congress. But you know what? It was the healthiest thing that happened to the Republican Party that there was a debate on economic policy in the late 70s. It was healthy that there was a debate between the Kissinger wing and the Reagan wing on foreign and defense policy. There were debates on social issues, obviously. And I don't think, I would err on the side of healthy debate and making your own arguments and floating things out there. And I would advise the leadership to err on the side of kind of tolerance for that, as opposed to artificial unity, which sort of cramps the Republican message and the ability to develop some new ideas, some new messages, some new tactics, if not even new, you know, fundamental ideas. Now, look, when you can unite on some key things in opposing Obama, that's important, and Pelosi, that's important to do, as you did this past week. And it's easier, of course, to unite in opposition, because you could all have different grounds to some degree for opposing the stimulus package. Some of you just don't like that amount of spending, I think it's terrible. Some of you think the amount's okay, but it was spent stupidly, et cetera. It's easier to unite in opposition. But I think on the positive side, a certain amount of disarray and sort of chaos is actually okay. Some of these ideas are really going to catch on, and I think backbenchers should feel free to intrude in areas that, you know, where there are powerful ranking members, and it's easy for me to say, of course, not be intimidated. And here's an example, just, you know, in December, the auto bailout came up in the Senate, who was this leading Republican spokesman on that, as it turned out? Bob Corker of Tennessee, who was, I believe, the most junior person on Senate banking, had no particular visibility, honestly, in the media or anything like that, and certainly not on banking issues. He's not from to my knowledge, he didn't have that much expertise even on banking. Very much to his credit, he educated himself. He went up to New York, met with a lot of people, went out and met with a lot of people in the auto industry, tried to really figure out how much of this was just ridiculous, how much of it was just kind of could be adjusted. Came up with a serious proposal and really helped, I think, helped make the case on that in a serious way. And he didn't get tasked, to my knowledge, to do that by Mitch McConnell or John Kyle. He just took it upon himself. And I think it's a real lesson. And incidentally, within a week, he was on the Sunday shows and he was the leading Republican spokesman on it and did a very good job. So I think for, you know, people who want to have that role, you all should empower yourselves and take on that role. Again, we don't know what's going to work. Some of these things will sort of fizzle out, even if they don't deserve to. Others will catch on. You never know ahead of time. But I think it's very important to have a lot of entrepreneurship from the ranks. Excuse me. Final point. Look, I really think, you know, I personally, I really do hope President Obama is a successful president in the sense that the country recovers from this economic crisis, and in the sense, especially in foreign policy, that we remain, and defense policy and national security, that we remain safe, that we complete the job successfully in Iraq, that we do well in Afghanistan, that we prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons, that we prevent a nuclear Pakistan from going off the cliff. I mean, there are huge challenges out there. We can't afford, it would be really damaging to the country, obviously, to have totally unsuccessful policies in all these areas. Having said that, I think it's also true that, given what we believe, we tend to think the country would be better off to have 4 years of an Obama presidency rather than eight, and better to have 2 or 4 years of Democratic control of Congress rather than 6 or 8. And I think it's therefore really important for the country what you all do in the next 2 to 4 years. It's not just a matter of getting partisan points or advancing one's own personal ambition. It really, I mean, 8 years of Obama presidency and a Democratic Congress, what that would imply for national security, for the courts, for that matter, for economic policy, for the size and scope of government, that's really, just personally, I think, a worrisome future for the country. And as I say, personally, I wish President Obama well, and certainly as Commander-in-Chief, I'm going to support him on things where I think he's doing the right thing, and I think you should too, honestly. I really don't think you can go too far the other way and just be sniping at everything, and I think that's foolish at this point politically and really not right. But I do think it would be better for the country to come back to having conservatives in power in the executive branch or in Congress, or preferably in both, preferably a revitalized, renewed, refreshed conservatism, which I think we will get over the next 2 to 4 years. And I don't, that won't be easy. You know, since 1896, every time a party has taken over the White House, they've controlled it for at least 8 years, with the exception of Carter in 76 to 80. But the norm is to hold the White House for 8 years. So, and the norm, incidentally, is to hold Congress for a fair stretch of time, as you know. Think of the House, 40 years Democrats, what, 12 years Republican. I mean, the norm is not really to flip it back and forth. So it's going to take a little bit of sort of running uphill, I would say, to change that norm. People tend to give the president the benefit of the doubt. They certainly want him to succeed, as we should. But I do think what this first couple of weeks shows is that, it reminds us the conservative ideas are very strong. We had a rough couple of elections. They weren't as bad as people say. Republicans did get 45% of the vote nationally. It's not as if the party totally fell off the cliff. And actually, since the election, Republicans have won the Georgia Senate seat and picked up a seat in Louisiana, probably pick up Gillibrand's seat in New York, may pick up the Fairfax County chairmanship actually next Tuesday. I actually think for a party that's supposed to be in such horrible shape, it's not really in that bad shape. Having said that, it was a rough couple of cycles. But the big news in the exit poll was that ideologically the country hasn't changed at all. The number of conservatives, moderates, liberals is pretty much the same. There are more conservatives than liberals. There are a lot of moderates. You need to get them. Young people is a real challenge, and that's why a refreshed and renewed conservatism is so important. But I think the good news is that the country is open to a conservative message. And the important news really is that it's important that you all deliver that message effectively, because I think it really, as in from 77 to 80, we're at a very important moment in the country's history. And it's not just a matter of winning some political victories and making yourselves feel better and picking up 12 seats in 2010 or something like that. It really is important for the sake of the country to oppose where you have to oppose on principle, and to do so effectively, and to propose sensible alternatives, to make people see what happens when you do go in the direction, unfortunately, that the Obama administration and the speaker have gone with this stimulus package, to really bring home the implications of this 6, 12, 18 months from now by monitoring what happens, and ultimately, I think, to get us back on track, both in Congress and at the presidential level in 2012. So I wish you well, and I'm happy to be with you, and we have some time for comments, questions, objections.
Hopefully we have the ladies and gentlemen passing with the microphones. If you'd raise your hand, and although we know you, Bill, may not, so introduce yourself.
Bill, you talked about some of the things that that we could do in a bold way. One thing that I thought of and we've done in the Georgia delegation, this boneheaded decision of Obama to shut down Guantanamo, knowing not what to do with the detainees, we dropped a resolution from the state of Georgia saying that no federal money would be spent to either transfer or house a Guantanamo detainees in any federal or military prison in the state of Georgia. Now, what I would like to do is encourage all 50 of our Republican delegations to do the exact same thing and hopefully get our leadership behind that, just to show a message that clearly not in our backyard. We don't want that. It's too dangerous, and it's a boneheaded decision. What do you think about something like that?
I mean, I have mixed views, honestly, but for this reason. I'm worried that it becomes just a not in my backyard issue. And it's like, well, we don't want it. I mean, which becomes like no one should have a maximum security prison. You know, Harry Reid doesn't want to have the nuclear waste in Yucca Mountain. And the people in Georgia are scared to have a few terrorists in some maximum security prison in Georgia. I don't think you want to frame the issue that way. I mean, I think it's fine if people want to do that in Georgia, and it might be a good way of getting a lot of local press about Obama's decision. But I wouldn't want to turn this ultimately into a not in my backyard issue. I want to turn this into what's safe for the country and what's best for the country issue. And so I'm a little nervous about this tendency. I can understand, believe me, why people are doing it at the local level, but I'm a little nervous about the notion that it's just going to look like a bunch of people, we don't want them near us. The truth is, if it was the right thing to do, maybe it will turn out incidentally that we have to house them in the United States. Well, then they have to be housed somewhere. And our position shouldn't be that, we should send them back to Yemen and release them, because then they will be back on the battlefield killing Americans. And I'm a little worried, therefore, about too much focus on the not in my backyard side of it.
I wouldn't really overemphasize that, but I think they need to stay at Guantanamo.
Well, no, as long as the preface is that they need to stay at Guantanamo. But the other thing that you should emphasize, in my opinion, on the Obama thing, it is, look, he ran on this, and I guess he was going to do a version of it, but it is a disservice to the Bush administration, to the people who worked on this in the administration, but also to the people who worked in Guantanamo and to the CIA interrogators and to everyone involved in the global war on terror to make it seem, as I think unfortunately President Obama has sort of made it seem, that we did something wrong, that we're embarrassed about what we did. I mean, this has been one of the most humane and conscientious efforts in world history to fight a very difficult war against people who do not respect the rules of war, the laws of war, in a way that was appropriate in terms of security, but also was humane and decent. And I mean, he has played into the European narrative that somehow the Americans have a huge amount to be embarrassed about in the last 6 years, when in fact, if you've talked to anyone who was a soldier assigned to Guantanamo, if you've talked to the operatives who were assigned to interrogate, they were very scrupulous and very careful in trying to do this as decently as possible. So I think a broader assault, my only point would be, I do think this is a weakness of, look, President Obama has gone out of his way, and I give him credit for this, to try to avoid the sort of left-wing, anti-American, anti-military, rhetoric that has been around for so long on the left. And he went out of his way to avoid it in his inaugural address, and he pays tribute to the soldiers and the troops, as he should, and all that. But I think on this Guantanamo issue, there's some vulnerability there in the sense that he's embraced a core element of the European anti-American narrative, and I wouldn't want to lose that side of it as well. I think Gitmo is a huge issue, though, and I was telling people, I think you guys should have hearings or whatever kind of hearings you can have on it. You should think of another proposal or criteria that he would have to certify as to why this is safe. I mean, Bush probably went too far, honestly, under pressure in sending people back over the last 2 to 3 years. The Defense Department says 62 of them returned to the battlefield. Some of those were tough judgment calls, but I mean, people do not understand. The ones who were still there are the ones the administration really felt they couldn't send. They want to send everyone back. No one liked having Guantanamo. It was bad PR. It's a big pain in the neck. It's expensive. If you could send them back and feel like these guys were going to disappear somewhere in Yemen or Pakistan and not be a problem, everyone would be thrilled to get rid of them, except for the few who were involved in 9/11 or the attack on the coal. But we are now down to the hard core of these guys. They sent back two-thirds of them. And for Obama to sort of blithely talk about how we're going to close Guantanamo and figure out how to give them trials, I do think it's a vulnerability, and I think people do understand it.
Joe Wilson from South Carolina, and I appreciate your resolve to promote success in Iraq. Today's a big day. Today is a very significant day in that country with the provincial elections. Could you give us your view about those elections and what you see as the next steps in the country of Iraq?
I mean, the elections are big, and if you talk to anyone who's, you know, brigade commanders who were back recently from Iraq, they think this is a key in getting buy-in across the board in a way we didn't get in 2005 at the provincial level. We have national elections at the end of the year. So I think they're on track to a pretty decent outcome. And contrary to all the pseudo-sophisticated analysis, it's going to end up being democracy that's the best thing we have going for us there, giving a lot of people a sense of buy-in to the political establishment. The worst thing we could have done actually would have been to try to find the right dictator early on and put him in charge. It really would have led, to a civil war. I think, you know, we've got to be careful not to draw down too fast. Elections require more troops to help preserve peace and security than fewer. I think one of the best things Bush did in his last year was put Petraeus at CENTCOM and Odierno in charge of MNFI. I don't think Obama's going to overrule them when they say we need this number of brigades still. But his people are putting a certain amount of pressure on them, I would say. And I think to the degree you all can, as you quite appropriately can, without getting in the middle of executive branch chain of command, deal with General Petraeus, deal with General Odierno, keep informed on what's happening, and be intelligent critics and, you know, people who issue warnings about what could happen down the road if the administration is reckless. I think that's extremely important. I mean, it would be horrible to fritter away a successful outcome in Iraq for the sake of a stupid promise that Obama made on the campaign trail. I mean, it would really be fundamentally irresponsible for an American president to do that. And I don't think he will, actually. But I think we need to keep an eye on it. I think, incidentally, to the degree, this is a separate issue, but you know, to the degree that we're putting pressure to draw down in Iraq faster so that we can send more brigades to Afghanistan, I think A, that's not true. I mean, the brigades going to Afghanistan aren't brigades that are now in Iraq anyway. But B, if that means we need a larger Army and Marine Corps, let's just increase the rate of building up the Army and Marine Corps. They already are exceeding their targets. One good thing about a bad recession is that a lot of young men and women decide the military is a good option for 4 or 8 years, since the job prospects elsewhere aren't great. We do need to build it up. It would be a perfectly appropriate part of a stimulus package, incidentally, if unemployment goes up. Instead of giving people unemployment benefits, let them join the military. That's better for them. It's better for the country. It's a better use of the money. And I think putting some pressure on to accelerate the increase in the size of the Army and the Marine Corps, as well as to incidentally spend a little more on some of the military programs that are underfunded now, and to refit some of what was drawn down in Iraq and Afghanistan. If they're going to spend a lot of money, that's a very good thing to spend money on. It's in the national interest. You know, it contributes to our national security. It's an awfully good alternative to some of the ridiculous things they're spending money on. So I think that would be part of it. We shouldn't let them say that we need to draw down in Iraq to send an adequate number of troops to Afghanistan. That really isn't true.
I know you may not have intended this specifically toward people like me, but I just wanted to thank you when you said you congratulated us on our intellectual assault. I've never had that compliment before, and I just wanted to say thank you so much, Bill.
I'm glad I made your day, you know. It's who knew it was so easy to make people happy, right?
Bill, I wanted to ask you about border security and immigration, because the Bush administration managed to alienate our base with its advocacy of that amnesty bill and the refusal to secure the border, and then sort of with the help of the media, because of our principled opposition to the amnesty bill and the refusal to secure the border, we, as a result of that whole debate, managed to alienate a lot of Hispanics very unfairly, and as a result, we've got unsecured borders, absolutely uncontrolled immigration over the border, full-scale border war between the narco-terrorists and the government of Mexico, real instability in Mexico. The government there has a genuine possibility of collapsing. This is a vitally important issue for the security of the country. It's in the hearts of our constituents who are angry and anxious. This is a huge issue across the country, and one that I think we're perfectly positioned to lead on in a way that's very constructive, by combining border security and welcoming legal immigrants into the country who want to come here and become Americans, learn English, and get a job. And could you talk to us about that and your perspective and help us raise and elevate the visibility of it?
I mean, I'm probably...
I'm John Culberson from Texas.
I'm probably not where some of you, or maybe most of you, are on immigration, but leaving aside what mix of security and legalization one is willing to be for, look, the greatest disaster, the disaster of immigration, you put well, was that we ended up with the worst of all worlds. And I would say the disaster of 2005, 2006, which were the worst 2 years, I mean, those years were the horrible years. I mean, 07, 08 was just the follow-on, really. The disaster of 05, 06 is we had a Republican president reelected with a majority of the vote, with a Republican Senate and a Republican Congress with increased numbers, and Bush's first two initiatives were Social Security, private accounts, and then his second initiative was immigration. Neither of them even got to a vote, basically, or I guess immigration sort of got to a vote in the Senate, and they both collapsed. And voters looked up, and I agree, so whichever side you were on, whether you were on the side of border security or comprehensive reform, all you knew is that your president, your Republican president, and your Republican members of Congress had been screaming and yelling that these were both extremely important initiatives, they had to be action taken on them, and nothing happened. The worst thing that can happen when you have a party controlled by, when one party controls both houses of Congress and the presidency, is failure. Nothing happened. This is what happened to Clinton in 93, 94 with health care. I mean, I remember telling Rove, whatever it's worth, in my judgment, just, you know, not having spent much time looking at it, in January of 05, was that Bush did not have a mandate for Social Security private accounts. It's a good idea in principle, but no one had campaigned on that in 04. The public wasn't ready for it. And to go with that first was to give a very fat target to the Democrats, which they exploited, and the administration didn't maybe do as good a job as it could have in explaining it. I think that actually could end up being a little like, I mean, the stimulus package will pass, but it's sort of similar in the sense of not really leading with an initiative that's not your strongest. But once that collapsed by September, and then immigration got front and center, we had a happy, you know, a civil war in the Republican Party on that for a year. That was a pretty, and Iraq went badly. Those three things together, I think, just, you know, destroyed Republicans in 06, and really 08 was just the follow-on in that respect to 06. This is why it's in many ways good news not to have a Republican president if you're a Republican member of Congress, because now you can develop your own proposals. I don't know how much traction you can get in the middle of a horrible recession with a lot of illegal immigrants leaving the country and in the middle of wars on sort of immigration as an issue or even border security as an issue. I mean, I just don't know enough about the details of what could be proposed in terms of some of the border security stuff. I think it's an interesting question if the Obama administration goes with some version of McCain-Kennedy, let's say. I assume that would split Republicans to some degree, maybe not. I don't know whether Rahm wants to make Democrats cast that vote. I guess I would have the attitude on immigration of stepping back, and they've got the, it should be dealt with in all kinds of ways. You guys should individually propose whatever you believe, but you know what? They've got the presidency, they've got the Congress, they spent the last 3 or 4 years telling Hispanics that it was incredibly irresponsible of the Republican Congress not to do anything. They spent some of them spent the last couple of years telling their moderate constituents that they were just as tough on immigration as all those conservative Republicans. Let them figure out how to do this, and I would frankly not regard it. I mean, this is just a tentative judgment. I haven't thought this through, but I'm not sure I'd regard that as an issue that you want to go particularly on the offense on. But again, I'm very much in a, people should do their own thing on this, you know, and someone might come up with something that hits a nerve that's not a solution to the whole problem but solves a little bit of the problem and say, well, look, we can't agree on the big thing. Why can't we agree on this? And suddenly it could take off. So I'm not dogmatic on this. I'm a little dubious that it should be at the center of your efforts. I do think, you know, when you have the degree of economic, I'll just close on this. I mean, there has been a little tendency, I think it's now going away, among Republicans to minimize the severity of the economic crisis. To, you know, in the old days, we had really bad recessions and unemployment was higher and people were tougher and they didn't complain. I think that's going to look ridiculous in a couple of months. We are in a very bad economic situation with the rate of acceleration of unemployment. The rate of deceleration of the economy is great. It's going to continue for a while. I think proposing pro-growth economic measures and opposing stupid economic measures without seeming to minimize the severity of the problem should take up a fair amount of your time. I think national security, ranging from Gitmo all the way to Iraq and Afghanistan and the size of the force, should take up quite a lot of time. health care is going to have to take up a lot of time. I assume Daschle, if he paid, I guess he did pay his back taxes, so now he could be part of the cabinet. Shouldn't they renominate Bill Richardson for Commerce Secretary, incidentally? How come Daschle and Geithner get to go through and poor Richardson is like thrown off the bus, you know? I assume health care will take up a lot of your time. There'll be a lot of really big issues. But again, I would just close by saying I encourage individual members to take up whatever they care the most about and really try to advance their agenda on those issues. Thanks a lot. Good luck.